This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Ethan Hawke, the actor, writes novels. Billy Bob Thornton has a new album out, so why shouldn't Carl Hiaasen, the best-selling Florida-based crime novelist, write a rock song? That song, which Hiaasen wrote and recorded with Warren Zevon, is featured in his new novel, Basket Case. In the novel, it's performed by rock star Jimmy Stoma. But Stoma's found dead, and obituary writer Jack Tagger becomes suspicious. Hiaasen came to fiction writing after a career in journalism. He still writes a twice-weekly column for the Miami Herald. A new collection of his columns has just been published called Paradise Screwed. Terry began her interview with Carl Hiaasen with a reading from the opening of his new novel, Basket Case.
Regarding the death of James Bradley Stomarty, what first catches my attention is his age. 39, that's 7 years younger than I am. I'm drawn to the young and old, but who isn't? The most avidly read obituaries are of those who died too soon and those who lasted beyond expectations. What everybody wants to know is, why them? What was their secret or their fatal mistake? Could the same happen to me? I like to know myself. Something else about James Bradley Stomarty, the name. I'm sure I've heard it before, but there's no clue in the facts from the funeral home. Private service is Tuesday, ashes to be scattered in the Atlantic. In lieu of flowers, the family requests donations be made to the Cousteau Society. That's classy. I scan the list of survived bys and note a wife, sister, uncle, mother. No kids, which is somewhat unusual for a 39-year-old straight guy, which I assume, from his marital status, James Bradley Stomarty to be. Tapping a key on my desktop, I am instantly wired into our morgue, although I'm the only one in the newsroom who still calls it that. Resource Retrieval Center is what the memos say, but morgue is more fitting. It's here they keep all dead stories dating back to 1975, which in a newspaper's memory is about as fresh as dinosaur dung. I type in the name of the deceased. Bingo. I'm careful not to chuckle or even smile, as I don't wish to alert my ever-watchful editor. Our newspaper publishes only one feature obituary each day. Other deaths are capsulized in brief paragraphs or ignored altogether. For years, the paper ran two daily full-length obits, but recently the death page lost space to the weather page, which had lost space to the celebrity eye page, which had lost space to horoscopes. The shrunken news hole leaves room for only a single story, so I am now cagey about committing to a subject. My editor is not the flexible sort. Once I tell her whom I'm writing about, there's no turning back, even if someone far more interesting expires later in the news cycle.
That's Carl Hiaasen reading from the opening of his new novel, Basket Case. So who is the person who has just died?
The person who has just died is a faded rock and roll star from the 80s who's known as Jimmy Stoma, who was the front man for an outrageous 80s band called Jimmy and the Slut Puppies.
Why did you want the mystery to revolve around the dead leader of a rock band?
If you work in a newsroom and you did this for a living, writing obituaries, you would it's the sort of story you would gravitate to because it has an instant sort of younger audience. It has some resonance with your own, you know, taste in music. And it's sort of a grab-me story. It's sort of you know right away it's going to be a good headline, so you want to do the story. And I just thought, for an obituary writer who as the narrator in my book, is sort of trying to write his way out of a bad job and looking for a big story to hang his star on, this is a good one. He sees this as his ticket back to respectability.
And of course, you had to write some lyrics for the book, and you actually even with Warren Zevon wrote a whole song, "Basket Case." Which is the hit single that the band had. It's also the title of your book. Before we actually hear some of this song, tell us why you felt you needed to actually make a record to be a companion with the book.
I don't know. It wasn't really something I felt I needed. It sounded like it was going to be fun at the time. The book was done, and the title of the book was all set. And I realized that there are lyrics sprinkled throughout the novel that I sort of had to write to fit the story and to fit certain songs that play a role in sorting out the mystery. And I only had two lines of lyrics for the song Basket Case. And Warren is a friend of mine, a great songwriter. And I said just on a kind of hoot, I said, would you mind, you know, wouldn't it be fun to help me finish this song? And we'd have a real song to go with the book. And he very graciously and some have some masochistic sense of friendship agreed to do it. And he and I worked out the lyrics, sort of faxing various lines back and forth, and we got those hammered out. He just did the music and sent me a CD one day and it had this great guitar lick in it, and it was really amazing. I called him back. I said, this is way too good for Jimmy and the Slud Puppies. What are we going to do now?
Well, I guess right now it's time to hear the record. So this is Basket Case with a lyric by Carl Hyacin and Warren Zevon, music by Warren Zevon, performed by Warren Zevon.
My baby is a basket case, a bipolar mama in leather and lace, face like an angel, she's a perfect waste. My baby is a basket case. Dragon and daughter, Calamity Jane, smoke on the water, water on the brain. She's pretty as a picture and totally crazed. My baby is a basket case.
Newspaper columnist and mystery writer Carl Hyacin is my guest. His new novel, Basket Case, isn't about an obituary writer who finds a mystery in the obituary that he's writing for a dead musician. How come you're still writing columns in spite of the fact that you're a very successful novelist?
Because I'm not a well person. I should have bailed a long time ago. Because I love the business. I believe in the business. It's a pure business. If you do it right and you do it with your heart, I mean, it does get in your veins. It's a cliche, but it's true. I grew up in it, sort of in the newsroom. I mean, I've been in the business a long time. I think there's nothing more noble than going out and writing an important story that can help someone who has no other voice speaking for him or her, and you can actually change lives in a positive way. It's a good business to be in, and it's hard to shake free of it. The other side of that, Terry, is also that there's no doubt that working in a place like South Florida, which is as weird as it gets, I certainly can mine the real life news stories and the real life characters and for the novels. I mean, one feeds the other, and there's just, you can't spend a couple days down there and not see how fertile the territory is for a novelist as well as for a journalist. So I'm certainly the two sides of that. My life complement each other in that way.
Yeah, you write about South Florida in your columns and in your novels. South Florida was surprisingly one of the centers of terrorist activity. I mean, several of the terrorists who were involved in the hijacking lived in South Florida for a while. I think they went to a flight school there. Is that right?
Yeah, there were 14 of the 19, amazingly, lived and had some training in South Florida. And
which
and
is kind of amazing. Like when you ask yourself, where would anti-Semitic hijackers most like to live? How about South Florida, where there's lots of Jewish retirees living?
Right. I mean, not far from where the butterfly ballots were falling for Pat Buchanan, improbably enough. I mean, there's so many. It seems like so many major news stories have some sort of South Florida connection. And I was amazed. I thought nothing would surprise me anymore. But when, after the tragedy here, and they started running the photos, the mugshots of these characters and where they lived and the addresses on their driver's licenses were all coming back to places in Florida. I thought, oh, my God, how could this possibly be? And, and I thought about it, and I even wrote about it to the extent that I think it is a place where outlaws have always felt comfortable. They've always accepted. They always blend in. And these are guys that are walking around paying for everything with cash, practically. South Florida opens its arms to anybody with cash in their pockets. And as we've exhibited with the drug trade over the years, it's a place where you can buy respectability, you can buy privacy, because it's a very transient place. Not many people who are born there hang around. I mean, it's just a place populated by people from other places, and they don't know their neighbors that well, and it was an easy place for these guys to get lost, and they had no problem whatsoever operating there and drew no suspicion to themselves.
Well, other things that have happened connected with terrorism in South Florida. The first anthrax letter was discovered at the office of the Globe in South Florida. Now, that may very well have been a domestic terrorist, but still terrorism. The flight from France on which the guy had explosives in his shoe was bound from Miami.
The Get Smart guy. Yeah, really. What reruns was he watching?
Has this gotten to a lot of people in South Florida? Are people starting to feel
we write
like,
about it. Yeah. Certainly, it's like how much of it you can take. We've got, this is an example. you just feel like there's a compass of weirdness, and no matter how many times it spins, that the arrow is going to point our way inevitably. And I use an example. After O.J. Simpson, the second trial in which the civil jury, found him culpable in the deaths of his wife and Ron Goldman, and he announced he'd be leaving L.A., you know, I remember saying to my wife, I said, you know what? That guy is moving to Miami. I'll bet you anything. And sure enough, there he is, and he's already drawing the attention of law enforcement authorities. Now, it just seems it's inevitable migration our way, but it's always been that way. Going back, I mean, in the Civil War, you had people running to South Florida hide. The old Wild West, a lot of the great outlaws of the Wild West spent time in Florida hiding out in the swamps. And I think, to some extent, most of the swamps are gone, but for whatever reason, the attraction of the place is still there.
Carl Hiaasen's new novel is Basket Case. He writes a column for the Miami Herald. We'll hear more of his conversation with Terry Gross after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with novelist and Miami Herald columnist Carl Hiaasen. His new novel is Basket Case.
Now, how did your family get to South Florida?
Well, my grandfather was originally from Norway, and his family migrated to North Dakota, and he got a law degree. And as soon as he had a job offer to get out of the North Dakota winters, he wasted no time hopping a train, and so he settled down there in 1922, which is considered ancient times. And my father was born down there, and I was, and my son, but that's not the common story. Most people are much newer arrivals than that.
Describe what it looked like then in your backyard or in your neighborhood. And we're talking about the 50s or the 60s?
Well, I was born in 53, and so, you know, in that time, if it rained, you were essentially, you know, in the swamp. One good rain, and you were pretty much waiting. You know, waiting out. If there was a road, you were waiting out to it. I mean, it was very, you know, you. It was just terribly flat, and probably to some people not very scenic, but to me, it was a wonderful place. You just got on your bike and you rode a very short distance, and you couldn't hear another car. You didn't hear a plane. You were in the middle of what was sort of a jungle. And when you were a kid, that was a great way to grow up. We caught snakes. We were out in the, you know, camping, fishing all the time, and it was just there was nothing else to do. I remember it was a big deal when the first convenience store opened up near our house. It was like 5 miles away, and it was considered that was a big deal. It was like a 7-Eleven or something that opened up, and it was like the grand opening of all time, you know. And now, of course, it's unrecognizable. You can celebrate when you find a lot that doesn't have something built on it. But at that time, it was all wild, and that was sort of the context in which some of the books were written. I mean, the contrast between a place that goes from that to being, you know, a big city so fast, you're bound to have, you know, people cracking up and people bursting, you know, the whole place bursting at the seams, which is what it seems like sometimes.
What was your personal reaction to that upheaval? Not your writer reaction, but your reaction as just a guy living in South Florida.
Well, you know, I just love the outdoors, and when you see it disappear, you walk around with a little bit of a sick feeling in your gut all the time, and that's why I always root. You know, you see these stories. I'm always rooting for the alligators over the poodles all the time. I have to say, they were there first, and they're going to be there long after we're gone. But I've always, you know, it's a helpless feeling. There's nothing, you can't change it. It's just sort of the engine of the economy. It's a beautiful place, and lots of people want to live there, and you're not going to stop them from living there. But at the same time, part of me always cheers when a big hurricane rears up and comes in and kicks some butt and sort of reminds us all that we live in a tropical hurricane zone. If we're going to build these nice houses, they better stand up to 150 mile an hour winds, or we're in the wrong neck of the woods.
A lot of people leave their hometowns. In fact, look forward to leaving their hometown so that they can get away from people who have defined them in a certain way, and they could be freer and, you know, reinvent themselves or just have a change of venue. Have you ever tried living outside of Florida?
No, I lived. I went to school for 2 years in Atlanta at Emory University, and it was fine. But I mean, I wasn't really living there. I was just going to school and going home. I haven't had any desire to. I mean, believe me, there are days when I wake up and look at the headlines in the Herald and say, you know, really, this isn't the place I want to be raising a family. But when you're born somewhere and become attached to it and have as much affection for at least the wilderness, the remaining wilderness that we have down there, I feel like I have some sort of moral duty to stay and fight for the place, because I think that if all of us who got disgruntled and discouraged left, then it's sort of a surrender. You know, you write about what you know best. You write about home and a place that you care about. And I certainly, maybe someday we'll set a book somewhere else, but I'm not going to purposely say, now I'm going to go do my book in Rome or Athens now. I mean, that would be kind of foolish for me.
Carl Hyacin, thanks so much for talking with us about your writing.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Journalist and novelist Carl Hyacin talking with Terry Gross. His new novel is Basket Case. A new collection of his columns for the Miami Herald is just out. It's called Paradise Screwed.